From health and wellness to education,
we need to be thinking about what it takes for students to succeed.
From art and politics to social issues of the day,
we have young Black males who are thriving in their communities and who are being shown as leaders.
The journey is what matters.
I would say to all of us, we can be better than we are.
Let's join Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, president of Howard University, and his guests as they take steps on the journey.
A professor steeped in the traditions of a culture, and a man who inspires students to know their history and live their promises, Dr. Greg Carr. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Welcome to The Journey. Welcome, Dr. Carr.
Thank you for having me, Brother Frederick. It's good to be here.
Dr. Carr, you're currently the chair of the Department of African American Studies here at Howard University, and you've occupied that position since 2001. You also teach in the Howard University Law School. Tell me, over the period of time that you've been here at Howard University, what have you seen change in the student body?
I think the student body, by and large, has pretty much mirrored the American student body generally in terms of their literacy. Technological literacy has been the biggest shift. As a classroom teacher, my primary objective is to not only introduce content to students, but to really prepare them to learn. And in how they learn, I've seen some shifts. You know, we deal with illiteracy a lot, people who are able to read but sometimes choose not to. Not as big a problem in the law school, obviously, because it's literacy based. But for our younger people, what I've found is that we have to create different ways for them to engage the text, not so that they won't engage the text, but so that they will. And that's probably been the biggest shift, Dr. Fred.
No, you clearly try to connect students back to their history. And it has been one of the foundation principles, I think, of your classroom. Why do you think this is important?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm first in my family to go to college, came out of Nashville, Tennessee, and my experience in education at Tennessee State really was anchored in the joy of learning. And that was connected to a study of our history and culture. After my second year in law school at Ohio State, I clerked in New York at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. It's funny because that's now being run by a sister who was on staff when I was there, my friend Sherilyn Eiffel. And I spent a lot of time in Harlem listening to some of the great elders in our teaching tradition, one who ended up being one of my mentors, John Henry Clark. Mm-hmm. And he said, all I ever wanted to be was a great classroom teacher. And I listened to him that summer. And after that, I just stuck with him till he passed away about 8 years later. And he introduced me to a different way of thinking about history. So I finished that law degree and went back, got a PhD, and have ever since then devoted my life to really helping us understand that without grounding in our history, we really don't have a vision for where we need to go.
Now, students today obviously did not live through the civil rights era, did not necessarily aren't as connected to that movement. What do you think they need to ground themselves in so that we don't lose that history or lose the impact of what that legacy has afforded them?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think, you know, the title of this classroom that you conduct every Sunday, The Journey, I think is appropriate to be the context for that question. Really, in many ways, time and place equal place. In other words, time, where you start from, and then space, where you think you are going, really determines your place, how you view yourself. Students who don't have a sense of themselves, people for that matter, in time and space, really have no sense of place. So their journey is circumscribed by their sense of the possible, also their sense of memory. So we have people, for example, who may think that everything's okay in this society. Well, the question then becomes, where are you starting from? If you start from yesterday, then it looks like progress, and then you can't explain the social problems that need to be solved. So students are ill-equipped to solve problems if they don't understand the context that these problems emerge from.
So with that in mind, obviously, you know, in today's society, we have a complicated social structure with systems that don't necessarily support it in a way that everyone can benefit. So with that in mind, what do you see the Howard grad after they come here? We reconnect them on that journey back to their past and their history, and then we launch them. What do you see their responsibility or their drive and motivation to go out and change that world around them? How do you see them performing those tasks?
Well, I mean, I think you've said it. Their responsibility is to change the world. And, you know, that's not a grandiose assertion. When we look at our sister institutions, I mean, several thousand institutions, maybe 3,000 or so institutions of higher education in this country, 2-year, 4-year, and so forth, Howard is one of only just over 100 HBCUs. Those institutions have a mission that is really something only they can do. And Howard, in those HBCUs, is the lead in that mission. And that's to connect to the world. Our sister institutions are like the University of West Indies, University of Cape Town, University of Ghana. Our students have to leave this institution ready to see the world and their place in it, not just the United States, not just their point of origin, but they have to be able to make connections in a world that really is moving past the nation state as the organizational context. You know, the Chinese, for example, have just set up a development bank that will probably rival and eclipse eventually the International Money Fund and the World Bank. Our Howard students are uniquely positioned to get involved in that conversation. A lot of our kids are second generation Nigerians. Look at CARICOM now moving into the reparations argument. We got kids who are second generation from Trinidad, from Jamaica, from Barbados. You know, our students coming to Howard are probably better equipped than any other students in this country to engage a global conversation, because that's where the world is going. And that's their obligation, I think.
Now, tell me a little bit about your own history and background in terms of your growing up. What was so unique about your experience in Nashville that prepared you for what you do today?
Well, brother, the most beautiful thing about me, I think, in terms of my journey, is that it is not unique. My people are from Alabama and Tennessee, man. Both farmers on both sides of my family. I'm the first in my family to go to college. I say that with pride, but I also say that to remind myself and others that, like you, we're just representative of the thousands, the millions who didn't get the chance. Went to Tennessee State. My great teachers there, McDonald Williams, head of the honors program. Jamie Williams, his wife, who was head of the School of Communications. I was a theater major. She edited the AME Church Review. And I knew reading and writing was important because I grew up in the church, you know, so early with the Bible, man, we go forward. But looking at those examples of black excellence, and that's why black colleges are so important, man. Those cats turned me around, man. I said, the book is what I want to do. I went to law school because I thought I wanted to do civil rights law. And when I got to law school, great mentors like Dave Williams, who is now the general counsel at Vanderbilt University, Leroy Purnell, who is now the dean of the law school at Florida A&M, black men who took me under their wing and said, all right, brother, what are you going to do with this law degree? And then I got involved in the idea of the life of the mind and decided that I wanted to be a professional academic. So I finished that degree, and then I went back to get my PhD and ended up in Philadelphia at Temple University. Malefi Asante, who a very powerful figure, one that I didn't always agree with, but I guess I got a reputation for not always agreeing, but still a comrade and a brother. And I studied with the great Egyptologist, Theophilo Benga. So that's part of my journey, brother.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Dr. Gregory Carr. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Now, just to switch gears a little bit, you teach in the law school.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that experience.
One of the beautiful things about Howard Law School is those students, largely of African descent, but not exclusively, since the beginning of Howard, that's always been the case, but these students come from all over the country. So I get students from Berkeley and students from University of Florida and Virginia, but they're of African descent. And for many of them, it's their first black college experience, but they are law students. Fortunately, the JD allows me to be in that space and to really engage in a deep study of the law.
Now, given the changes in our society and the contemporary nature of that civil rights fight, what do you think the Howard grad is getting that is so unique in that space that prepares them for that fight on a contemporary platform?
Well, as Dean Daniel Holly Walker often says, they get a good basic grounding in the law. The nuts and bolts of the law, the training, and they get incredible internship experiences. I sit in class and we talk about, for example, administration of justice, and I'm listening to students who do internships in the courts in D.C. and in Maryland and Virginia, and I listen to them talk about jury selection and voir dire and how racism is introduced in the jury box. These are students who are not just talking about this theoretically. They're going to work every day. It's really, and they're working for black judges, many of them. So it's really incredible to hear them bring that in and then theorize it with a deep study of 100 years of work, and then come over here to Moreland Spingarn, as I have them do every semester, and go through Charles Hamilton Houston's papers and see how he was addressing some of the very same issues. I think that's what makes Howard Law unique.
Right. If you could have dinner with someone, who would that person be and why? Oh, anyone, man. Alive or dead?
Well, living people, I like to believe we could sit and have dinner with them anytime. We could just get to them, right? So if I had to pick somebody from the past, oh my goodness. I started to say Louis Armstrong because that brother, but I think it might be W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm. This past semester, we had 1,000 freshmen over in the College of Arts and Sciences read his book, The Education of Black People, speeches to commencement addresses he gave, including one here at Howard in 1930. And of course, you spoke to that audience, introduced, and then came back and gave a talk to them. I would love to be able to listen to Du Bois, man, and say, so brother, what do you think happens next? And help me understand how we can be better teachers and better scholars. If I had one person, it'd probably be Du Bois.
No, he came about at a time where the transformation of higher education, especially as it spoke to, you know, back then the Negro, was in a major evolution. And that transformation, very much like today, for different reasons, but probably under the same social construct, interestingly enough.
Yes.
What is your perspective about how we use his teachings to probably guide us today in terms of how we meet today's challenges?
That's a great question. The last chapter in that book was a speech he gave at Johnson C. Smith University in 1960. It's called Whither Now and Why. Dr. Du Bois, who would leave for Ghana a couple of years after, he says to these people, and he's with social science teachers who were meeting at Johnson C. Smith that summer, he said, these laws are going to change. Segregation is going to go away. And then you're going to have to decide what you want to be in this society. Will you disappear into American society, or will you contribute what is unique about your people and their culture? I think that has been the major difference in the years since Du Bois passed, in the 50 years or so. We are still trying to answer that question. And as the American nation state changes, the demographics have shifted considerably. The first generation of students who will be majority non-white have already been born. They're 2 years old and younger. So by the time the next generation of Howard students gets ready to come here, they're going to be entering a country that looks a lot more like them even than it does today. And I think our challenge is to embrace our uniqueness and use it as a lens through which to elevate the entire country and the world. And in that respect, Du Bois called it with the last speech he gave at a black college before he left.
Now, the perspective of Du Bois can't necessarily, I think, take its full framework without a perspective on the civil rights movement and how that transformed, not just because of the laws, but more so, again, because of what it has done, I think, in terms of education. What's your perspective about the civil rights movement and that impact on education? To your point, today, how are we expressing ourselves in society through our educational institutions?
Yeah, so that's another good question, man. Well, since Brown, since 1954, we see in some places more segregation today than was around during the time of Brown versus the Board of Education. When we look at voting rights, for example, we see that the Voting Rights Act has been eviscerated by the Supreme Court in the last couple of years. And that's not to say that the Supreme Court didn't think it was doing the right thing, but intellectually, the architecture from the civil rights gains in some ways has been deconstructed. As it relates to education, I think our students have to now equip themselves with a deep understanding of not only the law, but how they're intervening in spaces where they can make a difference will make the difference. Our students who have gone out an alternative spring break, they came back from Ferguson after doing an incredible curriculum around how to educate people. So, and I'd say this, the ability of a young person to inspire even younger people cannot be overestimated. When these elementary school kids in D.C. or in St. Louis or Baltimore, Detroit see these young people coming in who know what they're talking about and who want to equip them with knowledge, they've lit a fire that when they leave, those students will do the rest. And I think that's where education comes in. It's about turning around and giving to other people what you've received on this campus.
Right. Now, at the top, you mentioned the changing landscape of the Howard student and the classroom. And clearly, as a former theater major, how much of that you think comes into your classroom? And I know some of your undergrad classes have more than 200 students. People complain if they have more than 10 students in a classroom. How do you feel that helps you connect with your audience in the classroom?
Well, Brother Peg, as far as workload goes, I'm sure that your mother would say the same thing my father would say. Look at our hands and say, boy, you don't go to work. They work long hours, brother, so I don't complain about the number of students I have. But as it relates to theater, I tell students all the time, I do and sometimes 4 shows a day, 4 days a week, meaning that you come in, you have to capture a student's attention. And once you capture their attention, the ability to learn, I think, is unearthed. This is what Fareed Zakaria says in his new book, In Defense of Liberal Education. He says, one of the most important things you can do at the undergraduate level is be inspired to learn. And if that means I got to tell a joke or I've got to make some movements or open the book and then let's read this book and make that come to life, then I thank God for Dury Cox and Devereaux Brady and some of those folks that trained me in theater at Tennessee State 30 years ago.
Well, I've said this to you before. I certainly thank you for being here. You have a uncanny resemblance to Stokely Carmichael.
Your homie.
And I think just as he transformed a lot, my guest today has been Dr. Gregory Carr. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, right here on the Howard University Radio Network.